Hello, welcome to Prime Lenses. I'm Ian. Each week, I speak with a guest about three lenses that have meant something to them on their photographic journey. And this week, my guest is Danny Bly. Danny returns for his Daniversary episode on the anniversary of the beginning of the podcast, and as he was the first guest, it seemed appropriate that he would be the first guest of year number two. Maybe we'll make this a thing, you know, a bit like Joseph and I were talking about revisiting stuff in the 20-year podcast project. Danny has made a bunch of changes to his gear in the last 12 months, and so it also seemed like a good time to have him back on to talk about moving from Leica to Canon, how that's worked for him, and just generally noodle around the houses on cameras that we love and why we'll never part with them. So, here is Danny Bly. Yeah, I'm back. Sorry about that.
No problem. And I'm back.
Yeah, you are. I know exactly what happened. I hit the hot corner for locking my screen.
Oh, I've done that many times.
And then that drops. You lock the screen. It drops the call. Just as you're smugly telling anyone that you're completely ready for this call, and you're like, everything's fine.
Take two.
Exactly. Look, it wouldn't be a Danny episode if it didn't start with some mild technical upheaval.
So true.
Well, welcome back. It is your Daniversary.
Daniversary, man, I love that. It's good to be back. You know, we've spent our last year texting about various camera thoughts and imagery.
Really has. It is funny to think it is a year.
Yeah,
that is kind of like quite a. It's flown by in a lot of ways.
Absolutely flown by.
And you've made some big changes.
I have made some huge changes. some of the changes were permanent. I can say that. Although, you know, most people probably would go, he'll be back. But there are some changes that I've made with my gear that are permanent. Talk to you about the changes that probably aren't permanent.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, start with that. So I think one of the things I was thinking about was your switchover of systems, and I'll let you describe it for listeners, is a bit like a painter changing mediums, but not completely. So it's sort of like going from oil to acrylic.
That's true. So in my case, it would be going from oil to acrylic back to oil.
Ah, okay.
That's how I would word it, because it was probably... Oh man, it was over 15 years ago now. I actually started on Canon. My first full frame sensor ever was a Canon, and a 50mm 1.4 lens. I shot concerts that I photographed everything that way. And so, you know, most people know my journey through everything. I tried everything. I tried versions of everything. And I ended up on Leica for everything. Work, play, testing, fun, anything I did was on Leica. And my most recent Leica work system was the Leica SL3, which I loved. It was amazing, met all my needs. But I started looking at other options. You know, I've had a lot of things serviced by Leica. You know, small, I refer to Leica as global boutique.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
They are global, but they are boutique. They're handmade, you know, they're so the resources available, they don't have, or they don't, you know, where you've got Canon service centers that can turn around a lens in days, Leica could be 3 months if you're lucky. So I was having some normal issues with some of my work lenses, my Leica SL work lenses, minor issues that I have, you know, just using them every day of my life, using them pretty hard. But the service times started to become problematic for me. When it was for work, you know, and I've got a turnaround client work, a lens being gone for over a year, you know, that's just the nature of the beast with, you know, with a boutique brand. So I tried some different systems, you know, in that time I went, you know, it's been a long time since I've even tried anything. So why don't I use this time while some of my main work lenses were gone? Why don't I use this time just to try some other things? I tried a Nikon ZF, loved it. You know, I tried some Fuji stuff, which I've always loved. And then I went, an RF system has looked impressive to me. To be more specific, the lenses have looked very impressive to me. So I rented, I think it was an R5 that I rented with a couple of just kind of my standard issue lenses that I don't do anything without. You know, I don't leave my house without a 50 millimeter lens.
Yeah.
So I tried it with the 50 millimeter 1.2. I went, oh my gosh, you know, the speed's here, the quality's here. I found the sensors to be, you know, I could manipulate the imagery. I could get it to what I wanted relatively quickly, which was not the case with other brands that I tried at all. Right. You know, I can name names if you want, but for what I do, there are some camera sensors that I cannot make work for what I. Now, you know, they may work for clients, but if I'm on a trip, they're just, I can't make them work for what I want. And Canon is a brand that I could make work for what I want. So I enjoyed the R5. I ended up, surprisingly, I don't know if it was after all my year shooting manual like an M, but I was going, you know, this is really fast. And that's not,
yeah,
I'm not feeling that to be a bad thing, that like this autofocus is crazy. So as I started leaning more into that tech, especially for work, you know, so man, I ended up going all the way with Canon. I have an R3, I have an R6. I loved the R5, but as you know this about me, I don't like large megapixel sensors. Mm-hmm. I just don't.
Yep.
I don't envision the scenario where I will ever enjoy a huge megapixel sensor. So the R6, tiny, light, small megapixels. So I use a Canon R3 now for any page. And for the last several months, I've used the R6, anything else. So
the interesting thing I find there about the lower megapixel thing, I do wonder whether we've kind of, for the longest time, 24 megapixel was kind of the default. You know, everything, right. Everything was 24 megapixel. It felt like for about a decade, that was like, even when there was an occasional 33 or 47 or whatever,
right.
You know, like we sort of as an industry established that 24 was pretty good for a lot of full frame right. cameras. And even not, you know, like the Ricoh GR is the same, but it's APS-C. But then all of a sudden we've kind of this arms race kicked off of like high megapixel
totally
sensors. Yeah.
And, you know, I'll be honest, in my experience, I understand that there are photographers that can utilize those kind of megapixels for work. I can tell you categorically, I'm not one of them.
Yeah.
I don't hate it. I feel to some degree that it's the camera manufacturers telling us, you want 100 megapixels more than I hear photographers asking for 100 megapixels, you know?
Yes.
So you're exactly right. It's a race they've entered.
It's funny because Canon, so Becca Fasaci was on last year and she went to a Canon event just before she came on to the podcast. And she said she was talking to them about why the newer models they were releasing were 24. And they said, well, it helps with everything. It helps with readout speeds. It means we can make the camera smaller. It means it's more power efficient. And actually for a lot of, you know, fast turnaround applications like sports, or if you're in the field, maybe doing some journalism.
Absolutely.
A 24 megapixel file is going to be absolutely plenty for
more than enough.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And when I shoot a lot of the events that I shoot with my Canon R3, I'm shooting burst modes. I'm coming home with, you know, I'm shooting 4,000 pictures easily in an hour and a half long.
Yeah.
You know, I want 24 megapixel files. There's tools I'll utilize on occasion. I use, you know, Topaz Lab makes a gigapixel AI that I'll use to upscale. But I mean, for a client, I'd be hard pressed to come up with a handful of scenarios where a client has needed that from me.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, and that's the other thing. So much work that we're doing now, the output of that work is only for social media.
Yeah, of course. You know,
even I was on a job. I've done billboard work with with 3.3 megapixel digital cameras. Wow. You know, my first ever, I think we talked about it on the podcast the first time. Yeah. My first ever digital camera was a 1.2 megapixel Fuji, and my upgrade to a 3.3 megapixel camera, I thought, there's no scenario I would, this is cool, but that was 3.3 megapixels. So yeah, 24 megapixel. I love the Canon R5. It has some video capabilities that I enjoy. This would be kind of nice to have in the field, but I'm not a big megapixel guy. That was my, you know, when I shot the Q2, which I shot the Q2, the Leica Q2 a lot, I didn't like, you know, the large megapixels. So when I was shooting the R3, to be honest, 95% of the client work I was doing, you know, that camera, it has a variable resolution sensor. I was shooting at 18 megapixel for the vast majority of my client work. I feel something is lost in resolution versus, you know, when I just think things, something has to give somewhere to get you a 60 to, you know, 100 megapixel image. And I feel it. Something needs to be traded off, and I don't, never a trade off that I want. Yeah. You know? So that's where I'm at now. I still have my Leica M10P reporter, but other than that, I'm on Canon for everything.
It was interesting from the outside looking in, like watching your journey through the different systems as you were trying stuff out. I was saying to Alice, I was like, you know, Danny's trying something else, and It's nice that you mentioned the ZF, because I think for a while there that was quite a, you liked that. I think the handling of that seemed nice. Was it the 40mm, the pancake as well? It's kind of pancakey. Yeah, that's a really cool.
Yes. Yeah, I really liked that. I wish I probably would have taken that system further if they made. I just feel in general Nikon lenses are too big for a body like that. They kind of designed that 40mm f2 for that body, and it's a perfect pair. But for anything else, I'm like, holy cow, my lens is a foot long on this little pocketable, almost pocketable camera. So I would have taken that system further if they had more dedicated lenses for it, honestly. Because I loved it. I loved the handling. It was capable. I loved the color output. So yeah, that was one I had. Yeah, I really enjoyed that, and I could see myself getting again. They really did a lot right with that camera, with the build quality and things. And there's rumors that Canon is working on something similar, so I would be all over. But again, it gave me this beautiful, well built, tactile body, but these modern, you know, kind of ugly lenses you're putting on it. And while they're, if I want an old school looking body, well, I want an old school look. And, you know, that's just something that, you know, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day, but it's important to me, I guess. You know, that's why I like him as you do.
A big part of it is how it looks. I think, you know, if Canon said they were going to make an A1 inspired modern digital, you know, with a bunch of lenses, it kind of looked that way. But it's funny because Leica have just put out that 50mm. I think I'm going to catch up with Milan Swolf, who was on before, about that 50. And it looks cool.
And that, I'll be honest, that 50's really looks cool. Yeah. It's really got my attention. That's always been my favorite, like a 50mm, is that version, that pre-spherical version. For me, they've been hard to find in kind of reliable, you know, they have the aperture's not great or whatever it may be, or the minimum focus distance. And they really answered a lot of those. So yeah, that, I'll be honest, that lens really has my attention. If there's my Leica purchase, it's pretty likely probably going to be that 50mm. Yeah.
Nope, it does look super cool. And I was very impressed. Like Milan texted me about a week ago and was like, are you in on the thing next week? And I went, no. And he was like, so he said, okay, I'll text you on Friday.
It definitely looks really cool. Now, in your case, though, you like to stick with, you know, I know you're a one camera guy.
Yes.
Could this be your only 50 millimeter lens?
So it potentially could, because it goes down. I've been contemplating kind of letting, you know, going down a little bit lower. So going down to like a 1.4 or something, and then you've got a bit more versatility in the bag. That's kind of the excuse. You know, that's the excuse for doing it. But having said that, like shooting at 5.6 f/8, you know, everything, things being in focus, I think the danger for me of having something that goes so low, as I found when I went to Wetzlar that time and I tried the Q2 mono, was that I felt so excited. I mean, it was like going to Disneyland, man. Like, I ran around, I had a great day. I shot loads of stuff at 1.7, you know, the reflected, like the mirror selfie in the lift and everything. Absolutely. And then that night over dinner, I sort of looked at the pictures I'd made and was like, well, I just got excited by shallow depth of field and how often I'd actually use it, you know?
That's a very fair point. And there's a lot of photographers, I'm not putting you in this camp, but there's a lot of photographers that I did exactly the same thing. When I got my first 50 millimeter 1.4 lens, I didn't take it off of 1.4 for probably a year, you know, because I have this depth of field. It's, you know, now, even now, my world is still kind of f1.4 to f5.6. There's not a lot, you know, as my photography will tell you, there's not a lot where I'm, you know, I'm not barely shooting landscapes, you know. So I go to 5.6, and I don't go much higher than that. I will say that reissue 51.4 absolutely has my attention. But then I over Leica M to put it on, so that would so then there's that decision also.
Well, you could modify it to your Canon gear as well. That'd be quite interesting. I see there's a fairly hardcore group of Sony users who take Leica glass and adapt it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and I've seen some of those adapters out there. I haven't tried any of them yet for my Canon, but I have seen them out there.
Yeah,
I could try my little my Leica Summicron, my 40 f/2 on it. That's been a staple. That lens is still a little staple for me, for sure.
Yeah. So I've been eyeing that one, but it's so close to my 35. I think I'd end up with too many steps in the bag.
It's too close. For me, I choose one or the other. I had the 5 steel rim, which for my use wasn't a very usable lens until f/2.
Yeah.
You know, it's so easy at 1.4. It gets better at 1.8. Some people love that haze. I'm just not one of them. So I got that. I shot my 35 steel rim as a 35 Summicron. So I just went, well, this is, you know, I could just have a cool Summicron then. And my little 40 millimeter is what I do. Now, I did modify my 40 millimeter. So it brings up 35 millimeter frame lines.
Okay.
Those to be more accurate. And I recently purchased a Voigtlander 40 millimeter 1.4 to bring up the 35 millimeter frame line. So it's really easy to do. I did that to both those. They act as my 35 millimeter lenses.
That 40 Voigtlander I just noticed today is in Severance, I think.
It is. Yes, it is. Yeah. Which he shoots it on. Oh, and we're that show.
So cool.
That's what he shoots on that. He shoots it on like an M3 or something.
I think
like
it's
that.
An M6 because it's got the wonky winder. It's got the angled the wonky winder, obviously the technical term.
He hasn't pulled out the Leica as much in this season. I've been a little disappointed, but he was using, Milchick was using that thing all over in season one.
Yeah, with the 240 flash as well. All the Leica branding very carefully removed or obfuscated.
Yeah. I found it interesting that, you know, I don't know why they would have, I love Voigtlander, but I don't know why they wouldn't have thrown a Leica lens on that thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
Production just didn't want to end as much. I don't know.
I guess I suspect that the set dressing person had in mind something like a steel rim, then saw the price of the steel rim and then thought.
And saw the price.
Yeah.
Well, we could spend this on, this money could be stretched further in the budget.
Absolutely.
Than running in to grab their step.
It
was fun.
Unless Ben Stiller has got a thing for Leica cameras that I don't know about.
Could be. Yeah, that could be too. Yeah, I caught that too, though. That's a good catch. Yeah. I'm glad you caught that little Voigtlander.
Yeah. Amazing TV show. For anyone listening, if you're not watching Severance, please watch Severance. It's extremely clever.
You know, and it's my wife and I, we sit down, and it's the only show we've been married almost 17 years. Mm-hmm. This is the only show that we go, okay, it's severance time. Right. Everything else, we go in our little theater at home.
Yeah.
Everything's door shut, the lights off, phones are on do not disturb. It's severance time. Oh, yeah, it's really amazing.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah. So clever. It's and also, just like the podcast, it's very, very important and mysterious work, Danny.
Very important and mysterious.
Absolutely.
But you may branch off into a severance podcast. There's quite a bit to discuss there.
Well, yeah, I've got a feeling that they've kind of jumped on that already and done, I think Adam Scott even does it. He does it with Ben Stiller. I think they're doing kind of an official companion podcast, I think. So
that would make a lot of sense. There's a lot to discuss there with that show.
It's very cool. Apparently he knows the end already. Yeah, I've been rewatching Babylon 5 recently, great show. And is that's the last show I remember hearing that the creator of that show knew what was going to happen right up until the end, like had index cards with the key the key plot points. And apparently the cast always wanted to know what was going to happen. He wouldn't tell them, and they would go and look at his desk and kind of like rifle around a bit and have a look on his desk, and they didn't realize it was on index cards in a little red box just up on the shelf. They could have looked at the entire thing and known like broadly where the show was going to go, and he just never told them.
It is not disappointed yet. So, and this season is moving. You know, season one was, you know, it's a relatively slow paced show. This season is really, it's taking off fast. Like they're getting to a lot quickly. It's the best. We're just obsessed with that show.
That's an interesting jumping off point. Makes me think of something. So obviously they're building their creative confidence in what they're making and as they're doing it. And they've clearly got the backing of people around them. That's how they can kind of pick up the pace and do things so quickly. How was your transition period? Because it's one thing to be shooting with different types of cameras and trying different stuff out. And it's in our game, it's a little bit like getting into loads of different cars. You're quite good at you get good at picking stuff up and finding where all the levers and switches are. And you're like, as long as I can, you know, find my controls quickly, then I know what I'm doing. I can hand me any camera and I'll know what I'm doing. How did you find that transition for work? Because it's one thing to do it on the side for a bit of fun, but it's your livelihood. So you know.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. Oh, man. And that was, it was a real process for me. It wasn't fast. When I switched to Canon and what a camera like the R3 can do, right, with its focus tracking, I said, okay, I'm invested in this system. I have almost all the Canon RF lenses. They probably make four Canon RF lenses that I don't own, okay? So I've gone, I am so heavily invested in this system, I'm going to dedicate to getting the most out of what I have here, okay? I'm months in, and I still will find myself on a shoot going, oh, it would be nice if one of these buttons did this really quick. And 4 months later, I'm still customizing maybe a button here or a button there. Now, I don't have the issue with this customization where on Sony, for me, maybe I'm just too dumb for Sony, but I felt like on Sony, I might have talked about this on our first episode, but I felt like I was one accidental button press away from getting into something I didn't know how to get myself back out of. Okay. So I may be on a client shoot going, oh, this, okay, I don't know what I pushed, but this isn't behaving, and I don't know how to fix it. I don't find that to be the case on Canon, but what I recommend, you know, I sat down and had coffee for 3 hours with a friend that recently switched over to a Canon 6, and I said, you have got to treat this like homework. You've got to sit down with the system, because if you don't want to do that, you don't need this camera. You know, the capabilities of what this can do and the tracking and things it can do. But that was a real process for me. Now, from a creative standpoint, you know, my complete switch, I'm hesitant to say I switched from, you know, from Leica to Canon, because I, you know, I'll always have some Leica. That'll always be part of what I do. But I seldom found with the final image. Now, there were times in the process of taking the image where maybe I felt, oh, this would have, you know, this would have, I would have probably felt more inspired by this if it was, felt like it was lacking, being taken with a Canon. There was no point creatively where I ever felt with Canon, oh, this would have been a better image on one of my Leicas. And that was huge for me. That I really needed that, you know, take it travel camera and something that's going to be in my bag. At the end of the day, I really needed that. You know, I'm so used to Leica and what those sensors do. I know like the back of my hand. And creatively, I really needed to get to a final image and not be disappointed that it wasn't shot on a Leica.
Yeah.
That was huge for me. You know, and I'm not recommending anyone else, you know, dive all in like I did, but I will say honestly, like I haven't regretted it for 1 second so far. These cameras really work for what I do. I never leaned into the tech on a camera like the Leica SL.
Mm-hmm.
I always used my SL even for paid jobs. I always used it like a Leica M, shy of, you know, I would let it autofocus. But, you know, I never got into tracking or anything, but I did that with Canon, and the capabilities have blown me away, to be honest. So I don't see myself, I don't see these cameras not meeting my needs anytime soon, but I do always see a place for the passion camera, being the, or like a Q3, you know, I shot the Leica Q3 43 for a week. Canon has not replaced my need for just a camera that I'm passionate about making images with. It's still, to me, there's nothing comparable to Leica for that. There's always going to be a Leica with me, but the Canon is blown me away.
It was fun to see, you know, when you were switching over, because you could see when you were trying different stuff, because you have, like me, I think, you know, and if people follow me on Instagram or follow you, they could tell pretty quickly what's an Ian photo, what's a Danny photo, because we have the stuff we shoot. We both have that thing where we like just chasing light around and taking a picture because it's pretty and just like enjoying that. And you have, like, you know, like I'm always joking with you about how I'm not jealous of your close focus on your coffee coffee photos, you know, like it's fine. Right. I'll just put a 90 mil on, Danny. It's okay. Which I do and sometimes.
Yeah. The other side of the room. And put
exactly. Becca Versace, when she tried the M11 recently, and she was like, yeah, I couldn't quite sort out that close focus thing with the 28. I was like, yeah, you put a 90 on and you stand back. Like, that's how we do it. Just like it's the 50s. But the thing that was really satisfying as someone looking at your work, because I don't see your professional work generally, like there's some of the stuff you post, but typically it's to follow you on social media is to be a fan of Danny's world, right? And I think what was interesting was, I said to Alice, when you were dialing that stuff in, and I you know, with the ZF and then with the Canon stuff, I could sort of see you were establishing the baseline first.
Exactly.
Stuff. And then I've seen you change it a little bit, because you remember I messaged you about the noise. I was like, have you changed the way you're doing this? Because you've started to get back. It's starting to look more like the Leica stuff. And you were like,
right.
Yeah. You've had to kind of play with the recipe a little bit. But do you think you've come out the other end with actually it's changed the recipe you use now for your homework and your commercial work, or were you just trying to get back?
You know, to be honest, it hasn't changed for my commercial work at all. That switch over creatively, visually, the final output, I was getting what I needed out of Canon for clients on day one. That process was exactly the same. Yeah, and the only place, if I'm just being, and I think this is the photography forum to be totally transparent, I have a hard time getting my look. If I'm directly comparing my Leica MNP with my vintage 4mm Summicron, versus any Canon equivalent, I'm not able to get what I get out of my Leica MP and a vintage lens. It's not the same. Now here's the only time I feel that lacking is when I am directly comparing them. You know, if I'm going, hey, this is a beautiful sunset, I'm going to run both these cameras outside. My preference is to the Leica M10P 10 times out of 10. Now, again, I only ever feel that when I'm directly comparing them. I haven't ever had my Canon creatively out in the field. Well, it's like you said, there's a big difference. My client work, I don't even, you know, I give my client work to my clients. I don't, my Instagram isn't about the work that I'm doing for clients. That's a lot of billboard stuff and a lot of cafe stuff. Occasionally I'll share some of that, like on my story, just to go, hey, here's some stuff I did that the Canon R3 can do. You know, I get a lot of messages, guys asking me about Canon stuff. So I'll kind of put that on there. But no, you kind of nailed it on the head. My personal work is really just what's right in front of me at that time.
Yeah.
Trying to elevate what's right in front of me at that time. It's kind of an interesting contrast, because for client work, I am chasing the shot, the epic shot that I got, and I didn't miss it. For my personal work, I've almost taken a stance of, I don't want anything about this to feel epic. I want this to feel like anyone, this could be in anyone's world, and awe it this way, you know.
Just while you were saying there about showing anyone's world, it's a good excuse to bring up the book. And I know you don't want to do another found photos book, but I wonder whether your work actually influenced you in picking, because one of the things that you did with that work, when you found those images at those, you know, thrift stores, car boot sales, whatever it was that you found them, and you went through them, do you think that was what appealed to you about it, was that you were seeing other people's lives depicted in the way that you depict them?
I think for sure, and I'll be honest, part of the joy in that project, I mean, I went through tens of thousands of Kodachrome slides. I literally tens of thousands. Part of the joy, I'll tell you something I really learned in that project. Almost no one was photographing for the art of photography in 99.99% of the imagery I found was documentation. Okay. Yeah. To find the beauty in that documentation, well, that's exactly what I do with my personal. So, you know, we have the work of artists now, like Vivian Meyer, who knew exactly what she was looking for. Okay. Mm. So many of the Kodachrome slides that I went through, it was documenting not for the art, not for the beautiful light. They were just documenting what was in front of them. Mm. So to kind of pick out beautiful work in that, oh my gosh, like that. And that was a fun project. I still, even a year later, I don't think I would do that again, just for the amount, you know, the technicalities behind cleaning and making pristine, you know, and just scanning. I would lock myself in my office for days. I would come out for meals and I would lock myself away for days with piles of Kodachrome slides. And, you know, it was a passion project. I don't know if I would do it. Oh, and those books are gone. So if you have one, like, that's I'm happy for you. I don't even think I would do like another printing of the initial book of volume one. I called it volume one, thinking I would do more, and I don't think we'll see a volume two. I think that was, you know, and I think those books went into the right hands, people that you know, could appreciate, you know, finding that work. But yeah, but that is what it was. I think it's going to stay as that.
Yeah. Well, my copy is sitting behind me on my shelf.
I love it.
I get it down every so often and show it to the boys and stuff, because the boys are getting interested in photography. But I do think it's interesting, because we are sometimes, I think, dismissive of the way that people use smartphone cameras and depict and take pictures of everything and take pictures of their world. But actually, that's what cameras have been for most people for most of their life. Polaroids, you know, they were just people catching their world around them, weren't they?
Exactly that. Yeah, exactly that. And it was so inspiring to find that, you know, that there, most of the Kodachrome slides I would go through were a picture of a piano because they were going to send a newspaper because it was for sale, you know, like almost anti-art, you know, but the process easy to dismiss going, well, okay, I don't really need to look any deeper at this image.
Yeah.
You know, but then I would, beautiful image of people on the ferry to the Statue of Liberty. You know, it was interesting too, you know, because it was work. All that was work by, I couldn't tell you how many, my guess is 50 different photographers, you know, are, and I found the process of laying it out to be so much more difficult than laying out, more so than I would have anticipated. Like laying out my own work is so easy for me. It's second nature. I didn't anticipate that process being that difficult. To, you know, as you open a page, I want there to be a flow and a purpose behind one image, what image is next to the other. And man, with my own work, I don't have to think about it. That just happens. It's really easy for me. I was not anticipating the difficulty of getting that flow in such an array of work, you know, but that was a lot of work too, that part of it.
Yeah, I suppose going through all the images and trying to tell a story with it. There was a recent episode where I spoke to some people who are restoring the work of a photographer and called Alice Longstaff, who was a British photographer who grew up in a place called Hebden Bridge. And she kept it all. She kept all the negatives, but some of them, they just get pulled out of the box. They were put in there maybe 60, 70 years ago, and they've not been taken out by anyone since, and it's the first time looking at them. And so, you know, trying to curate that, he was saying, getting that down, Alex was talking about it, like getting that down from like you find a couple of hundred interesting images and then whittling that down to maybe 30 or 40 for an exhibition or maybe 60 for a book. Like, very hard to do and tell a story.
It's very hard to do. And while it was a joy to find kind of the needle in the haystack in my book, it was a joy to find those kind of where everything kind of hit the mark. It was so rare. It was so much of snapshots, not for the sake of art. It was, you know, what I use the example of take a random person off the street and roll through their iPhone camera roll. How much art is in there? None. My camera roll is none. You know, my camera roll is a receipt that I need to remember the tracking number for, you know, back then people were running around with Kodachrome slide film as the way we shoot with our iPhones now. So to go through, you know, tens of thousands of images to find the art, it's akin to taking a random person's iPhone and finding something that you would print in a book.
Very hard to do. I had a related incident today. So this would be a spoiler if it was going out sooner, but it isn't. So tomorrow, Alice has an appointment at the hospital. And what we sometimes do is when we're leaving or we're going places, we will be going past the window if the other one is working or going past whatever. And we will flip each other the bird to kind of signify to try and distract the other person.
I love that. So
earlier today I had a moment like between calls and I thought, what would be really funny if I did a Polaroid of me doing it and I just stick it to the steering wheel of the car in the garage.
I love it.
So when she gets in the car tomorrow, she'll see it. And I did it on a timer. I got the shot and then I accidentally pressed the button and I've taken a beautiful picture, which I've stuck in my notebook, of the ceiling in my office. And it's like, that's a thing we don't do anymore. Like we had photos when we were kids of my dad looking down at the camera and accidentally firing off a shot in his face, which we've all done, right? When you're loading film. Yeah. So, but these are kind of remnants of a bygone age. And I gleefully stuck the picture in my notebook so that I wouldn't lose it because I just thought, that was.
I love that. You know, I know you shoot Polaroid. Your aesthetic and your kind of what I know of your philosophy on, I'm going to say photography as a whole. You strike me as someone who would connect strongly with film photography, and I do wonder if that's you know, if you're on the path to that at all, if you've even.
I have a bit. So there's regular listeners will have picked up on a few episodes. I mean, Tiffany Roubert was on, and she shoots an MP exclusively and shoots film.
Nice.
And she does it for professional work. Cici Liu, who was on, of course, shoots a lot of film as well.
Okay.
Ben, who was on, shoots Polaroids. I tend to shoot Polaroid because I really like it. However, I live in a cold place. And so Polaroid doesn't love the cold, although I've been doing experiments with Polaroid cold clips. If you've ever come across the Polaroid cold clip.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, so I didn't know this existed until a few weeks ago. So for people who don't know, the Polaroid cold clip is two sheets of aluminium held together literally with like duct tape at the bottom, right? And oftentimes they've had to be repaired over the years because the tape disintegrates.
Sure.
But basically they're two pieces of aluminium about half a millimeter thick, so very, very thin. And you put them in your pocket for about 5 minutes. There are even instructions on it in different languages. So it says it's for developing at temperatures below 65 degrees Fahrenheit or 18 degrees Celsius, right? So, where I live in Nethy Bridge, there's no way that we don't see 18 degrees very often. Like, even in the house sometimes, you know, it can be quite cold.
Yeah.
So I've been testing this out because I feel like it can probably improve the photos. And what I've found is that it significantly improves the performance of the chemistry.
What?
So this appeals to me tremendously because you're right, film photography is appealing because photography as a whole is also a system that you can learn
Absolutely.
And that you can kind of master it.
Absolutely.
And then, you know,
Absolutely.
That kind of consistency is so satisfying and it's so exciting. It's like going around a track, or anything you can do repeatedly and well is a satisfying, fun thing to do. So I'm really enjoying playing with Polaroid and using things like the cold clips or knowing to keep it in a pocket and things like that and getting the extra performance out of it. But I think I'm not patient enough for film often. that's part of the problem. I'd love an M5.
No.
I'd love an M5 and shoot it, but like behind me is the tiny Canon that we talked about last time, the little point and shoot film camera that was my stepdad's. That's on the shelf behind me. It has a roll of film in it. I've nearly shot it, but I've not finished the roll and I've not sent it away to be developed. And I should kind of get on that. So yeah, film is funny.
That's, you know, I had a time with film. I shot a Leica M6 and I would shoot Kodak film. When I was into it, I was obsessed with it.
Yeah.
But I was doing home development because, I mean, I didn't have the patience for home development. I absolutely don't have the patience to send my rolls off and get them a month later. And film is at a place right now where it's so popular. I mean, you know, these film labs, a good film lab, you know, I've heard stories from friends that, you know, you can wait 2 months. I was even finding it hard for me to get through the end of the roll. I would kind of waste shots at the end of a roll because I want to see, you know, I want to get on here. I got into the strong appeal of film. It did speak to me, but I'm most likely done. I probably wouldn't ever shoot film again for me.
Yeah.
It's exactly what you said. It's down to the patience for me. I also am someone, I get tired of my own photography. You know, I don't remember on this last time, but if I post my own photography, it's because I shot it that day or that last few days. I do a lot of posts where I say, here's the last few days of life in photography. If I look at something 2 weeks old, I don't enjoy it anymore of my own work. So that was a huge struggle with film for me also is, you know, sometimes I'm looking at something 2 months old and it's just it didn't end up sticking with me, but you know, it's its own thing. It's its own craft.
I think I don't have nostalgia. You know how sometimes folks get nostalgic for something they didn't, like they never had?
Sure.
So vinyl is a good example of this.
Sure.
And I don't disagree that like, vinyl is nicer to listen to in a lot of ways because it's not compressed and the sound stage is broader.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the thing is, when I think about photography and I think about my connection with other art forms, things like music and film and stuff, I did grow up in an age when film was analog and projected. So I do, and I like the collective group experience of experiencing a film with other people. I think that's a really powerful and wonderful thing. But I didn't grow up with a lot of vinyl around me. I discovered music really through CDs and then through MP3s and through iPods and things like that. And similarly with photography, although I used film cameras when I was a kid and was occasionally allowed to shoot a Polaroid, like one or two frames maybe, when I discovered photography in a big way was when I got an Ixus, little point and shoot, and then I remember like really going, oh, I was wringing of hands over buying my own DSLR when I bought a Nikon D40. And he doesn't listen to podcasts, but spoilers, we picked up another one for my eldest for his birthday in July.
That's perfect.
So I've got one. It's mint, and I managed to find it on eBay for £60 last night. It's amazing. So that's going to be something that we do. But so we'll have another one of those in our lives, which is really nice. But the thing is, because I came up with those things, I have a nostalgia for that era, not the one before.
That makes so much sense, honestly. You know, and there's a huge trend right now of I have a photographer friend who is currently seeking out some of, by today's standards, some of the worst spec digital cameras you can find. There's a little movement happening of those things are kind of coming back into popularity, you know, because there's a character there with, you know, things are so good now and so clean now. And any brand can work for anything. If I'm being honest, you know, any brand work for my clients today. If it's a new camera, I can get it to do what the needs of my clients. I can make it do that. But yeah, there's a trend happening with, you know, you make a great point. My photographic nostalgia is for a 1 megapixel Fuji digital camera, not for, you know, a Leica M3. It's, you know, so I understand the artistic appeal to that. But yeah, you're right. I'm with you. I don't share that nostalgia in that regard.
I tell you what, though, I went back and I used the Sofort 2 the other weekend.
I took
that out for fun because that's a 5 megapixel teeny tiny sensor.
That's fun.
And I still love that camera for what it is. It's a party camera.
For what it is.
Right?
For what it is.
But it's much, much better when it's used as a printer for higher quality images because it's also an Instax printer. So it makes
100%.
It yeah. But have you seen the Instax Wide hybrid that they've just released?
No, I don't think I've seen that.
Strap in. So here's the thing. And here's that, like it keeps being advertised to me on Instagram and I keep looking at it and I'm making lots of noises in Alice's direction in the hopes that, like, you know, it may appear at some point. I'm like, hey, do you know, it'd be really good. But the thing that they've done, they've done the hybrid thing of digital, but it's a printer, but it's a wide, it's an Instax Wide this time.
Okay.
But the thing that is compelling and the thing that they should take forward if they can, if it's not prohibitively expensive, into the other Instax hybrids in future, is it's a 16 megapixel camera.
Oh wow.
So suddenly you've got something there that will potentially actually produce a better image, because the big limitation of the Sofort 2 is that 5 megapixels on a very small sensor with a 2.4 millimeter lens, it's just not enough to kind of justify carrying something separate when I could just use a phone.
That was my exact, I shot a Sofort 2. I had one for a little bit and I would get a lot of questions about it. I had one pretty early.
Yeah.
And I would get so many questions. Tell me about the Sofort. And first and foremost, I tell people, you know, you know what this camera is. You have to know what this camera isn't.
Yes. Yeah. For selfies and friends, I'm going to the London camera show in a couple of weeks. And in fact, your episode, I think, will go out when I'm at the London camera show.
Oh,
and
nice.
It's probably coming with me on that trip because I'm going to bump into a bunch of previous guests and talk to other people.
See, that's awesome.
And so I'll take it because it'll be perfect for that. It'll be great for selfies and handout pictures.
It's perfect for that. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, but I'm not taking a landscape shot with a cell phone too.
I wonder, too, with your work and your photography, you know, you're a one camera guy, mm-hmm. you know. I understand the philosophy. I've been that way, you know. But I wonder if let me put it to you this way. With my work, I wish I could be a one camera guy, and I think I wrote about this on my I wrote a blog post at DannyBly.com about my switch to Canon. I would be a Leica M only guy if I could be. There's kind of, I talked to you a lot about, you know, you're living with one hand tied behind your back and why only let yourself try anything else. But I absolutely have, you know, maybe part of that is like my, I wish I was in a place to do that. You know, with my amount of, you know, my client work is, you know, that's all Canon now. But, you know, the Leica M is still just a special piece of equipment. The Leica M Digital is, you know, and so and you're shooting the primarily 50 millimeter?
35 a lot of the time, or the 50 Summicron.
Okay.
Yeah. So my 35 Zeiss. Yeah. Yep. Or the 50 Summicron. And again, I remember we spoke about this in the past that like I'm probably a Kron guy more than a Summilux guy because I do still want a little bit more of that texture, that it's a little bit more clinical. Not as clinical as a Zeiss or a modern lens, but the Summilux is sort of, I don't want to say soft because it's not soft, but there's slightly less texture or detail somehow, you know?
Well, and honestly, I mean, I always tell people creatively, I say, you don't need to make a change while you're happy. Exactly. If you're happy with what, you know, wait until you're unhappy and then make a change with something. Mm. If you're, you know, the grass is not always greener creatively on the other side. You know, my switch, for lack of a better term, from Leica to Canon was not a subtle decision. It was not, you know, I held on to almost all of my Leicas through that switch because I didn't know what was going to come out at the other end, you know. Mm. I'm happy with the switch. Will I always own a Leica for the passion? Yes. Is Canon a passion brand for me? No. I would like to see Canon enter a space, you know, where Nikon has entered of, you know, of vintage inspired tactile buttons. And I would like to see that. I would love to see that, but Leica is, you know, there's still only one, you know, it's nothing is close.
No, so I think the only other brand that might get there might be someone like Fuji one day.
Yeah,
they might sort of move in that direction. But again, Canon and Sony do so much. Like I've spoken on the show to like a bunch of different, obviously people who shoot all sorts of different systems. And I think that if you're looking at like the health of the broad kind of photography ecosystem, Canon, Nikon, and Sony need to be there. There is a job to be done, right? And we need to capture it, and it needs to be weather sealed, and it needs to be well made, and it needs to have a good service interval. All of that good stuff. You need them to be kind of sort of tripping over each other to try and one up each other and do a different thing. There can be different flavors within that. I feel like Canon are not trying to be Sony by going, there's this 24 megapixel thing, and it's this. And if the rumors are true, they're looking at compacts again. You know, we might get new kind of G7s and stuff like that, which would be really exciting. So I think that's good. Nikon seem to have the bird people all sorted.
Yeah,
that seems great. True. And it seems to all work.
They've got the bird bracket.
They've got the bird people. And let's be honest, I saw something a while back and it still makes me chuckle. It was someone on Reddit or something saying that the price of the Leica Q3 was an affront to photographers and it was harming consumers. I was like, my friend, when you're in the market of selling these things to Lewis Hamilton and Lionel Messi, I promise you no one was harmed. Like nobody was made to buy that. Peter McKinnon wasn't made to buy that Q2 reporter.
Right. And I'm going to be honest. I mean, There is such an array of options now to a photographer. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And everything now is good. I haven't that I thought was bad. Everything the Fuji, I tried the Fuji X100 VI or 6.
Yeah,
and
6, yeah.
It was amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I haven't anything being released today is great. I would go as far as say for client work, like I said, I could use anything that was out now. They're all great.
Yeah.
You know, so it really, Canon for me came down to one simple element. I have a history with that brand. I started professionally on Canon. I was happy with it. So that's where I started looking. When I started looking at, okay, what's next for me for clients with, you know, that's where I started looking. And I did have to dive in both feet though into the technology of these cameras.
Yeah.
You know, the R3, by all accounts, is easily the best, most capable camera I've ever used ever, you know, but I only use it for client work, you know.
Right.
So yeah, these cameras have a place. The Canon R3 is not marketing itself as being the take everywhere Ricoh GR alternative.
No.
This is a work tool, you know, and for me, it does everything I could ever dream of it doing, you know.
No, it's really cool. So you think you're kind of there for a while? Yeah,
I am. Yeah. Yeah. Now, in terms of for work, I'm probably here for good. You know, I'm so happy with the lenses. I'm so happy with the lens performance. You know, I care about lenses more than I care about sensors. You know.
Yeah.
So, I'm probably in the Canon RF system now. I don't see a reason. I can't think of a compelling reason that I would even consider another option, to be honest. For me, they're that good.
Yeah.
But I always preface that with for work, for client work.
I was just going to say, but for the latte cam, we can go anywhere.
That's right. Probably still, there will probably always be a Leica that exists in my arsenal at my disposal.
Yeah.
You know, I like I said, I'm still a guy, you know, and I shoot Leica because I'm a guy that still cares about that passion of making the image.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what Leica's all about. Still is, probably always will be, you know. So even if I didn't have my Leica M, I would buy an original Leica Q again. Like, there's always going to be one.
Yep.
You know.
Yep, exactly. I mean, and don't get me wrong, I'm very tempted by the Q. That 28mm lens, when I had Stefan Daniel on, and he was saying, well, we can't put that lens on anything else because it's less than a millimeter away from the sensor. So you just, it's machined. It's made for that thing.
For
that's it.
Yep.
It's just, there's nowhere else. So that 1.7 will live there forever. Although I do have a 1.7 coming actually in the post. I had a guy, last weekend's episode, as we record, was Joseph de Giovanna, who does the 30-year time-lapse project in New York.
Oh, so wow.
And also, I have foolishly agreed, I think, to do this for another 20 years, just to kind of to keep check. I think he wants a long-term project, buddy. We're going to do that. But one of his lenses was a Pentax 50
1.7. Wow, I'm not.
Came out. And if you look it up, it's very vintage, but they can be had for like $20 to $40 depending on condition.
Okay.
So I picked one up with an adapter. One of the things though that's appealing about it, aside from the fact that it's lovely manual focus 1.7 and all that sort of stuff, I don't have a 50 that goes down that low, but also the dot on the side for mounting onto the camera is a Prime Lenses yellow.
It was made for you.
It was meant to be, my friend.
And you have
it's on the way.
You have so you'll mount that onto your M.
Yes, I've got an adapter coming. Yeah.
Oh, I cannot wait to see what that does.
Yeah,
that's gonna be fun. That's going to be awesome. I like kind of marrying truly vintage glass like that with tech. Yeah. You know, and I'll eventually try some Canon RF stuff, or I'll try some Leica M stuff on my RF. But
yeah,
I still kind of feel like, well, I've got a camera for those M mounts. You know, so the most I've ever done was I adapted M glass when I had the SL system, because they still kind of felt, you know, married to each other in a way. But I've never tried, you know, and I know there's photographers that swear by M glass, you know, on their Sonys and things. I've just have never tried it. You know, I've just never been compelled to try it. So
I think if you've got the camera that can do it. I saw a video a while back, and you know, you always, if it's on YouTube, you always have to sort of slightly query just how scientifically it was done. But he mounted, I think it was a 50 Summicron to both an A7 adapted, Sony A7, and then obviously compared it with the performance on the M11. Because they, you know, if the rumors are true, they basically have the same sensor. And what was interesting was how it still rendered a better quality image on the Leica. But of course it did, because it's built for that. It's not going through an adapter.
Exactly. Yeah, it's built for it. Yeah, it's married to it. You know?
That's where they will do all the testing. And I did find at Christmas, when I did my ridiculous test with that NovaFlex, insane lens, that when that's adapted onto my M, I can't focus to infinity. It doesn't quite reach. I think it's because the adapter I've got is too thick. And so it's close.
To my eye, you shoot a lot of stuff that needs infinity focus. You know, you do a lot of.
Yeah, lot so of I was all right because it was birds and they were closer.
Oh, okay.
So basically, but when I stuck.
Gotcha.
So the five, it's two, that lens, for people who don't know, is a NovaFlex 560 and 400 kit that was done for the Leica R system, the film system, back in the day. And you shoot it like a gun. It's hilarious. It's amazing. Yeah. And the 560 is better than the 400 because there's a bigger area of the surface of the lens that's kind of sharper and in focus. So I was using that a lot to photograph. There's a woodpecker in our garden that comes down to the bird feeder a lot. So I was getting great shots of the woodpecker. It's really good. Wow. They're on my Instagram. But the thing was that was really close. And when it came to the other thing that sort of lens would be ideal for is getting a photo of the moon. Because it's... And so it's so annoying because the photo, I can set it up on a tripod, I can get it all the focus, you know, the moon's not moving anywhere. And you can just see how it's just a fraction out of focus. It's so close to being in focus.
Quite getting you to infinity.
But yeah, it doesn't quite get me to infinity.
Oh,
and so,
man. You know...
I would
like to see those images, though. Mm. You know, I've been thinking some about this. I'm not a sentimental person in the least bit, but I'll tell you what kind of got me thinking about this, because I sold my Leica M10P reporter recently. I sold it months ago, and I sold it to a good friend of mine. His name's Howie, and I sold it to him, going, "Look, dude, like, here's the thing. I want to see you with this if I'm not using it. So here's my thing. If you end up moving on, I'm probably going to buy it back from you. Okay. So he sent me a message, and you know, he went, "Hey, you know, I'm going to move to the film MP for everything." So I said, "Okay, well, let's get it back here. You know, let's get it back." And I've never been a sentimental person. I'm still not. I probably have some sentimentality to that camera if you were to force me to choose it, you know, but you know, if you've kind of gained any sentimental value for your Leica M yet, or any of your lenses.
Oh, definitely. Well, so when I switched last year, I switched from the 10 to the 11 just before we started doing the podcast.
I
was a bit, this will sound so stupid, I was a bit cross at myself for doing it initially, and I missed the 10. In a bunch of ways. I missed the base plate. I missed where the paint was going off. There was something about it. But I've really come to love the 11 because I think a bunch of what I was seeing in the images, or not in the images, the bunch of what I was feeling wasn't borne out in the images. And again, it comes back to what you come up through. You know, I can't... Being sentimental about a base plate is silly because... I didn't come up through that. I just got used to using it. And it's just, you know, it was just a thing that I did. And actually, My workflow is so nice with the 11, and it's the silly things, right? Like the paint is rubbing off in the places where I handle it a lot and change things on like the ISO dial and stuff. And so there are many like it, but this one is mine. And I think, and if the rumors are true, then the M12 is a little ways off anyway. And what will it even be? Maybe there will be something else in between, you know. So I'm very happy shooting that thing at 36 megapixels forever, really. Like, it's very, very good. And the modern conveniences of charging the thing over USB-C and the really long battery, you know, it's good.
That is something I've missed. I wish I had that capability. You know, everything's USB-C now, so I mean, I could travel with one charger. You know, my M10P reporter, my green and brass one, has, it's so beat up. You know, it has the marks on it from, I could show you, well, this was, I was at the zoo with my daughter, and this is where it scraped against this cave in the alligator part of the zoo. Yeah. My friend Howie, when he was using it, he went, you know, this, the reporter, it never even felt like mine. He said, you know, the whole time I had it, it still felt like yours. And I said, you know, I understand. That thing has several years of my life marks on it. So that's one, if I was ever going to be sentimental, it would probably be to that one. But I still don't even know if I'm sentimental to that one or not. I don't know. I've never been that way. But I understand how someone could be, you know, because it's, you know, you're attaching memories. All those marks is a memory attached to it. Oh, but yeah.
I was delighted when the paint started rubbing off on the ISO dial. I got very excited. And it's because it's that is mine, you know.
It's yours. Yeah. Those are your life marks on it. You know?
Yeah. That's how I used it. Yeah.
At the end of the day, there's a reason, you know, how we've discussed any modern digital camera, you're going to get usable files. I don't care what anybody says. Yeah. Like you're going to get good files out of any modern digital camera. There's a reason we choose the limitations of a Leica M. You know, there's a heritage there and the brand, and you know, there's just a lot more that goes into it with Leica. So I'll always have one. I'll never be at a point where it's no part of my creative journey whatsoever. That I don't envision that. Yeah. But right now, I'm a lot of Canon right now, though.
Yeah. Oh, that's really good. Well, I'm glad to hear. And that's actually kind of like a nice note to sort of end our annual check-in on in a lovely way. Yeah. You know,
I've kind of been looking a little bit at maybe a Leica did an M11 black paint that's kind of nice looking. Maybe there'll be one of those in my future. I'm not sure, but yeah, when we do this next year, we'll we'll see what changes have come to us.
Yeah. Oh, lovely, man. Well, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you for being the first guest of year one and the first guest of year two. I feel like that's a lovely precedent for us to set.
I love it, man. And I'll see you next year.
Yeah. All right, bud. Take care.
All right, man. You too.
Bye. Thanks, Danny. It was great to talk to you again. Let's do it next year. We'll see how we go. If you enjoyed that conversation, don't forget that you can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. That's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube Music, Amazon Music, all the places. You can also sign up to the weekly newsletter that goes out every Wednesday, and that's on ianfarrell.com/sign-up. That's a pretty good way to start year two, I think. It's all right, isn't it? We've got some cracking people lined up, and I was just at the London Photography Show last weekend, and boy howdy, I've met some fun folks. So I'm really excited to bring you some great conversations in 2025 and through to 26. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.